Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Cliff. You know, we talk a lot about ancient civilizations, ancient cultures, their influence on us today. And there's nothing more impressive and more impactful than visiting ancient cities, ancient remains of people. And I'm doing a tour. I'm taking a tour with an agency. And I'd like you to come with me. It's a Maya in the Mexico tour. It's coming up October 28th through November 4th. And we're going to visit, we're going to climb, we're going to explore the ancient Mayan cities in the Yucatan Peninsula. This is like a really amazing opportunity to see these ruins up close and personal. And there's so much mystery around the Maya that the only way you can connect with them is to go and be there. And I've been going down to the Yucatan Peninsula for years, and this is a great chance to come down with me and see what I'm talking about. See these splendid buildings, these pyramids. We'll climb the pyramids. We're going to see Uxmal. We're going to see Coba, Sayil, Chichen Itza. We're going to go to a cenote. We're going to see the great museums in the area too. Mérida, which is where we're going to be based, has one of the best museums you would imagine. It's just great. And then we're also going to go south of that, and we're going to go down the Puuc Trail. Puuc is a design style. You can read all about it. Go to Earth Ancients. Go to the tours page. Go to earthancients.com. Go to tours and check out the itinerary. And I've been talking about this for the last many weeks. And, you know, we tried to do this before. It was really expensive with this last company, over $3,000. I've cut it almost in half. So check it out. Come out and join me. This is going to be a great time. October 28th through November 4th. And as kind of a bonus, that's when they're doing Day of the Dead, and they have a huge parade. Everybody in town dresses up. Hey, we'll dress up too. So Mexico, Maya, Yucatan Peninsula, you fly down, 1, 2, 3, you're there with me. Come on out. Come on and join me. Hey, today's show features some new discoveries in Peru, and this is very, very cool. This is a species of humanoid that they've found, like nothing you can imagine. Very strange being with three fingers on both hands and three toes. And Gaia, my sponsor, got involved. Boy, what they uncovered is pretty cool. So stay tuned for today's show. Here it is. For June 24th, 2017, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Well, hey, this week you might think you're listening to an episode of Ancient Aliens, literally. the big news of the week is this discovery of this mummy found in the hills of Nazca, Peru. And if you're not familiar with Nazca is famous for these unusual massive glyphs, these ground-based glyphs of animals, of figurines, of very, very cool shapes. And they only can be seen by people that are above them. They were first spotted in the 20s when planes were flying over that part of Peru. And it's curious. I mean, Eric Von Däniken in his book, early books, talks about the possibility of these being alien constructs, started a whole wildfire around them. But this figure was found in some nearby caves, and it's a mummified figure. And Gaia, one of my sponsors, has a whole program on these, and we're going to talk a little bit about this later. And I've seen the video a couple of times. I spoke with the producers at Gaia, I was supposed to have a producer on today, but they are being very, very cautious. They don't want to get into legal problems of making certain claims. They've already done it in a way by producing this video. And in the video, they actually show this this humanoid. He's got he or she had a very long head. It has quite normal features, except the eyes are huge. But what's really amazing is this person, a humanoid, this being, there we go, this being has very long fingers and very long toes, and there are three digits on each finger and each toe. Now, they've already done some very extensive x-rays and run it through an MRI, and if this thing is fake, it's one of the best fake reproductions of a humanoid I've ever seen. The x-rays quite literally show detailed skeletal structure. It looks like the being has more ribs than we do. These fingers, when you see this, the video, and you can see it on the Facebook page, go to Earth Ancients, go to Facebook, go to groups, has, I think it's like five digits in the hand, in the fingers. And Jesus Christ, it's like everybody's like all over the place on this thing. The guy who found it is a French scientist, and he's been down there in Peru for a while. He actually has a website too, which I'll talk about a little bit later in the show. But apparently, he's been finding these very odd artifacts for a number of years in and around this outer area of these Nazca glyphs. He's found them in caves. He's found them in various parts of the area, in burial sites. And not only has he found skeletal remains, he's also actually also found some artifacts that are quite interesting. Gaia gets into it to the point where they actually show evidence of artifacts that represent similar types of beings. And in these artifacts, which are cloth, which are pottery, there's figurines that have three fingers. And so they kind of justify this discovery by showing these images, these artifacts. Now, something that's very strange to me also, and they found this in the x-rays, and once the x-rays were done, they actually found them in the actual remaining body parts. There's metal composite insertions in the hands, in the finger areas, and there's also some structure within the stomach area that looks like, if it's not metal, it might be some kind of stones. Why a figure would have stones in the gut, I wouldn't have a clue. These metal clips in the hand area, though, makes people wonder if these were, you know, connected to some kind of computer system, some kind of a enhancement of the body that would connect this being with some system of some kind. But that is very, very, very curious. And you'll see all the details as we move forward into the news segment. But, Kat, big news this week, mummified alien found in Peru. And it's gone viral. I just read it about a few hours ago in UK Daily. That's read by millions of people. It's all over the news in CNN. So this is quite an interesting find. Now, the first thing people do is fine. It's easy to say it's a fake, and all the skeptics are going to be all over this thing. So far, there hasn't been any evidence of it being a fraud or a hoax. But, you know, who knows? Again, we're in a period of our history where we can reproduce pretty much anything through CGI. And if this mummy is a fake, it's one of the best I've ever seen. It's It's a work of art. It's so good. So stay tuned for that. Hey, also, this week we're introducing a new segment. We have Ashley Cowie, the Scottish historian who we've had on before. He's living in Colombia, South America. And he'll join me each week to talk a little bit about what he's up to, some of the subjects that are current events. And today we're going to provide a we're going to provide him with an opportunity to pipe in about what he believes is going on with this mummy, the Peruvian mummy. We'll let you know all about it.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
One small step for man, one giant leap for man.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And again, the big news of the week is this Peruvian mummy. And the gentleman who has been making these discoveries is a Frenchman, a French scientist named Thierry Jamin. He's based in Peru. His organization is called the Alien Project. It's part of the Cusco Institute. And Jamin has been publishing articles and actually small galleries in this website of his, the Alien Project. And I've posted it on the Facebook page. And a couple of his galleries are quite unique. He's got one that I have posted where he shows these strange artifacts. He has a number of other mummified objects, including very elongated alien-looking craniums. He's got a number of body parts of these very strange three-finger aliens. I can only call them aliens because obviously they don't look at all like we do today. Maybe the face is somewhat similar, but they have very elongated heads. It's noted that they probably have two or more ribs than we do. We don't have an idea what the internal physiology is, if they have a heart or lungs or things like that. But they do have a rib cage. They have the skeletal system is very similar to ours. Except they have these elongated fingers. Now, I mentioned earlier in the show that Gaia has gone forward and produced a video on these, and you can see the video on the Facebook page. So Thierry Jamin is the lead investigator, the one who's been collecting these artifacts, and they're pretty startling. They really are. And if they're fake, I don't know. You know, when I started posting these, and I've been posting for the last 3 or 4 days on the Facebook page, I had a lot of comments of people that were kind of upset about it. You know, why are you posting these? If it's true, it's significant. And possibly these individuals had, influenced cultures. By the way, the dating so far is between 800 and 1,000 years old, these mummified remains. So you can see the whole thing. Earth Ancients, go to the group page, and it's pretty spectacular stuff. It really is. Hey, and as I was saying, people get upset about this stuff, and I basically wrote a small reply. Look, if you're upset about it, go on, move on. This is going to upset some people if it turns out to be true. But it's funny. If you think about it, if this group of aliens, if this is one of a group of people who live in this part of Peru, what's wrong with that? You know, is it that upsetting? Do you really believe that we are the only people in the world, the only beings in the entire universe? I mean, even Carl Sagan said that there's the probability of other planets being seeded with humanoids or creatures is very, very high. So, I mean, you got to kind of let it sink in a little bit if it's true. Now, It may not be true. This might be all hogwash or whatever. But hey, if it is true, isn't that cool? Isn't that a great possibility? So, I don't know. I've been into this stuff for years, and for me, I've always wanted to have a ship land and go, hey, here we are. We've been here for forever or whatever. And yeah, you're not the only ones that live in the universe. So welcome. So anyhow, don't let it upset you. If it does, it shouldn't upset you. Again, Gaia is sponsoring this video. You can see the full video on the Facebook page. It has all the details of this strange creature and all the other material that they found. So check it out. You can see the whole nine yards. I've put a whole bunch of galleries on there, and you'll be able to see it in quite a bit of detail. It's nothing to get upset about. Check it out. There's also some interesting galleries that I've posted on the Facebook page. What else? So we have a couple of galleries. We have some galleries from some discoveries of very early Greek sculptures that are very cool. We have a gallery of a megalithic monument that's found in southern Sweden. It looks kind of like an oval Stonehenge. And this was submitted by one of our viewers. And there's some of these stones weigh in excess of 2 tons. And how they move them is anyone's guess. The details are pretty interesting. So check that out. Jan-Peter de Jong, our friend from the Netherlands, sent in a new gallery from Cusco, Peru, which highlights some of the strange masonry in the area. And hey, by the way, thanks, Jan. There's about 50 photographs of some of the masonry in the upper Cusco area above Sacsayhuaman, which is where the huge stones are located. And these galleries, these stone masonry photos show manipulation of stone from some off-world beings, or maybe they were, humanoids that had some kind of tools to move the stone around. But you can see huge sections taken off of stone clusters, and it's formed in a way that looks like they troweled it when it was molten or something. But whatever they did is very, very interesting. and you can see the entire gallery on the Facebook page. Always remember that each day there is material that is posted on the Facebook page, and we continue to do that so that you're updated. Now, some of this material, some of the articles that I write are on my website, but I've pretty much decided to post on the Facebook page because I can get stuff out as quickly as possible. And it gives an opportunity for you, the listener, to post as you find material that you find interesting. So check it out. Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to the group page, and it's all there. So we have a new segment this week. I mentioned it to you. It's working with Ashley Cowie. He's a Scottish historian, and Ashley's a lot of fun. And we bounce stuff off each other. He has been around for a while. He has his own program, and it's the People's History Show. And he's been doing that for a few years, and he's coming to us today from Colombia, South America. So we're adding a new segment to our weekly program here. I really like the work of Ashley Cowie. And Ashley and I have kind of like, you know, talked about a lot of stuff. His opinion is quite unique. If you don't know Ashley, he's a Scottish historian. He's an author. He's also a TV host of the People's History Show in Scotland, which is very, very popular. And he's got quite a following. If you look him up on Facebook, you'll see that he has quite a few people that are keeping an eye on what he has to say. So, hey, how you doing, Ashley? What's going on?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, all's good.
Cool. Hey, so I want to talk about this mummy that has gone viral, and I want your opinion on it. Now, this mummy was found in a cave close to the Nazca landforms that are in Peru. And before it was found, a French archaeologist also found a number of, and this is months ago, it might have been actually a year ago, he found a number of bones in caves. And a series of the bones were these hands, these three-finger hands, that were extremely curious. People began thinking, oh, this is BS, it's a bunch of crap, until this mummy was found. And Gaia and a number of other institutions have been spending huge money, I mean, thousands of dollars to get it scanned. And the skeletal system is very, very odd. So what do you think, man? You think it's a bunch of crap or what? What's your story?
I think a really important thing you just said there was that it cost them several thousands of dollars to get it investigated. I think it could have cost tens of thousands of dollars to get it 3D printed.
Ah, okay. Now, why are you coming up with 3D printing? Because the technology has come around to the point where they can do really subtle stuff? Because remember, we're looking at, you know, a body, and you see it in the video, and they actually have x-rayed it, and it's got an unusual number of vertebrae and a number, I think it's got one or two extra rib cage, ribs, too. So, but how, I mean, that's a big pull-off.
No, okay, I agree. I think it is a big pull-off, and the only way they're going to pull it off is it being big. Just the way David Blaine has to be in a glass box over the River Thames for 2 months. So let's just look at 3D printing for a second, and let's look at this mummy. When I say 3D printing, I don't just mean printing a picture of your family and having it on your mantelpiece like commercial 3D printers. What I'm talking about here are medical 3D printers. You know that people are printing with human genes now, Cliff. People can print ears with your genes. What I think the next reveal on this mummy is going to be, this is my prediction. Now, if I make this prediction and it comes right, we're heading towards a hoax. My prediction is, the next thing they're going to find is a really unusual genetic mapping or a genetic form within a sample of that thing. And that's going to get more publicity, set the world alight again with all of the, is this truth, is it hoax? But I do believe that none of the most respected anthropologists or natural scientists are going to get near this thing. I think it's going to remain within a group of people who are probably behind this thing, because I do believe it's a hoax. And the reason I think it's a hoax is, I mean, two simple things. One is, why is there only one of them? And the second is, where in the human evolutionary system is there space for a three-fingered humanoid? It doesn't fit our understanding of the evolution of humanity.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think it could be a spin-off of humanoids, a hominin that, you know, just was spun off somewhere? I mean, honestly, that's a possibility. I think it's, honestly, if it does turn out to be real, and by the way, they're doing the DNA, but the DNA testing takes forever, so... But
I think we've got to consider in this, okay, is I love, somebody said this to me once, and I am totally ripped it off. I wish I was clever enough to say this myself. He said to me, with stuff like this, you have to approach it skeptically, and through skeptical analysis, you generally find mysteries are dissolved. And I think by remaining skeptical on this sort of thing, you're always going to be proven right. 99% of these things are hoaxes, right?
When it comes to physical bodies, I think a lot of them are hoaxes, or they are not what they appear to be. And there's been a number of many alien bodies, smaller humanoid type of bodies that have been found in Peru. So I don't know. It's weird.
Yes, but you know, here's the thing. Back to what I was just about to say, that what my friend said to me was this. He goes, aliens, let's look at this. This is what the implication is, that this is an alien life form. It doesn't have ears. It doesn't have eyes. Slitty eyes. So what he said was, aliens and UFOs always take the form of pop culture at the time. In the 1970s, people were spotting UFOs with little metal ladders that you climbed up because Buck Rogers was on. Then Matrix comes along, and all of a sudden, people are experiencing interdimensional shit, right? So if that mummy in Peru had a set of ears, I might be going, my goodness, this might be right. But the fact that it matches the pop cultural image of an E.T. designed as a grey alien in the last 20 years, it's just too much. If it was a lizard or a worm or something that was a standalone species, yes, I'll go with it, because we're finding between 3 and 6 species a day, still new, that we didn't know about.
Yeah.
But for it to be so abstract from the human evolutionary chain, I just think it's going to... But I'll tell you something. Here's the thing. The great thing with history is the fact that this has been created as a hoax, in 200 years, that hoax, that creation will be part of history. That's the great thing with history nowadays. The creation of hoaxes become part of history.
Yeah.
And I think this could be one of the bigger ones.
Well, I'm waiting for more analysis, because they've already shown what this creature may have looked like when it stood straight up. It was about 5'6" or 5'7". It has three toes on the feet, both feet, three fingers, and it looks weird, but it looks humanoid, you know. And when you see the close-ups of these fingers, it's quite elaborate, and it's quite fun for me, but it scares the crap out of a lot of other people, because they're like, oh, I don't know if I want to go there. I think people are afraid.
That's what I do.
I think people are very afraid about this, and they get very uncomfortable when they see it, and that's too bad. I kind of hope it is an alien. It'd be cool.
I think cool is kind of an understatement, but this, and I think when we look at what it actually would be, what we're talking about is if this is what they claim it is, religion stops tomorrow. Okay.
Why?
Why? Because we are not the center of God's creation on earth. There's life on another planet. It stops.
Okay.
So come on, are you telling me that 10 days ago somebody discovered life on another planet and everything just ticks on as normal? If it was truly found, the world would stop in its tracks. Okay. That's a fact.
Now, you said that before we came on, and I told you what my belief is the world was not going to stop. Now, it's gone viral. I just saw it on UK Daily, which is tens of millions of people look at that every day. But that's kind of like a rag, like the Post. I think that if it is true, enough people are beginning to look at it. And I think the possibilities are really out there. But we have to find out. We need to know more about it.
Why don't you and I do something? We're going to be talking each week. Why don't we put a little wager on this?
Okay.
All right. So what could that be?
6-pack of very good craft style brew. Now, the problem with that is in Colombia, that's going to be a hard one for you. You're probably going to have to fly home to Scotland and send me a 6-pack.
No. This is going to be infinitely harder for you, because when you talk to a Scots guy about a 6-pack, that's 6 kegs. So let's do this.
Forget it, man. I'll be under the table.
Indeed.
I don't care. Let's wager a 22-ounce bottle of very good beer. Let's just say that.
Yeah, let's do that. And I think what we should do is on each time we talk, we give a sign 1 minute to for me to update you on why that's a hoax, and for you to tell me why I might just be wrong.
Well, hey, I'll be honest with you. I'm very open-minded about it. I'm not saying it's either or, hoax or real. I don't know yet. I've seen a lot of this over the years. I've been a program director and written about it, so I don't know. But it sure looks pretty cool. I mean, if this is a hoax, they went to great lengths to make this thing a hoax, because the skeletal system that is shown in these scans is extremely sophisticated. Oh, here's the other reason I think it may not be a hoax. In a number of these hands that they show, there's these metal attachments. They're attached to the bone. And it's like it's some kind of a enhancement of some kind. Maybe the metal connects with a very advanced computer, or
it could possibly be how the retired zoologist joined the animal bones onto the human. Alternatively,
hey, well, we'll have to see. We'll have to see. So, anyhow,
do you know what does come from this? Though I think the most important thing is whether that is or not what it claims to be. It raises questions. It makes us think beyond ourselves, and that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it totally is. But this is one thing I thought was interesting, and I have to applaud Gaia for doing this. They actually pulled together some artifacts from about 1,000 years ago to 800 years ago that show that a lot of the reproduction, the characters in these designs and paintings have three fingers and three toes. And it's quite interesting.
I thought it was super interesting, too. And, you know, I got right into that. I looked at it and I thought, oh, my goodness, they do. So let me put this at you. I know a lot of prehistoric art that has eight-armed blue elephants. You seen those around?
Oh, my God.
Come on.
No, I haven't seen those.
The selective choosing of artifacts. History is like an infinite pond. What they do is they come up with a conclusion, then find the symbols in the painting and the artworks to support that predetermined conclusion. I just think it's all guff, and I truly do. And it's only because I've, like you, experienced so many similar things, and for all of my 20s, I bought into them, and some of them I believed and truly wanted this to happen. And every one of them's let me down, to be honest with you. I've been able to rationalize and apply logic to these things, and I just expect this to be the same. Plus, one thing I've got to put at you here is this. Last year, when that French scientist told the world he'd found a three-fingered hand in a cave in Peru, I, like a lot of other people, asked for access to see, to interview, and to photograph. Do you know the only way that a scientist, me, you, or anyone else can get to see that hand? Is after a £2,500 tour of Peru with a company, and you get to see it on the last day. It's bullshit. It's a commercial tour. Yeah, and I'm not going to be rude and say the big guy's name on this show. It's just not fair, but I think it's just pulling the piss and making a fool of people just a little bit too far. We've found an alien artifact. We're not giving it to science, but if you give us $2,500 for a tour, you get to see it before you go home. I think it's cheap.
I don't like that either.
No, but fortunately, it's the same guy who's found the full skeleton now, so he must have made a few quid on the hand and he's just decided to this one was the whole body.
Okay. Hey, Ashley, thanks for your 2 cents, man. It's going to be nice checking in with you each week. And for those of you listening, Ashley is a regular contributor to Ancient Origins magazine. He writes a nice column, and we'll be talking about some of his articles. We'll talk about some of his discoveries, and if it happens to also coincide with a TV show he's doing, we want to talk about that too. So, hey, Ashley, welcome aboard, man.
Nice one. I can't wait to get this off the ground.
All right. We'll talk to you again.
Cheers for now.
So that's Ashley. I call him Ash. And you can go to his website. It's Ashley Cowie, COWIE.com. And he's got quite a few articles on there. He's written a couple of books. And his galleries are kind of fun. He also posts photos from the TV program that he does every other week. So, and then it's sent over to Scotland. I don't know about this creature, this alien. I remain open. Again, we are in the age of the high-tech printing technology, and again, if it is this 3D printer that's made this creature, it is one of the best things I've ever seen. I don't think it is. I think it's the real deal. I think we're going to see that this thing is very, 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 very original. But we don't know. Nobody knows. It's funny to consider. So we stay tuned. We all sit and stay tuned, and I will stay tuned with you. Keeping on the alien theme today, don't worry, folks. I'm not going to the dark side, which is the ancient alien side. but we're having Colin Andrews back today to give us more information about this Cygnus alien megastructure and the connection it has with Earth's past. Now, Andrew's written a number of books. He's written an early book on the Cygnus mystery, and actually that's the title of the book. And he's got a new book coming out in the fall, which is a follow-up to the megastructure that astronomers have been looking at for the last year or so that just came up. So this is a follow-up to the brief talk we had with interview this with Andrew. This is quite a detailed interview. I think you're going to like it.
A couple of weeks ago, we had Andrew Collins on the program as kind of a follow-up. We had a quick segment with him talking about this Cygnus alien mega structure. Man, it's all about aliens this week. So, and I didn't know that Colin had written a number of articles and even a book in 1999 called The Cygnus Mystery, where he talks about this influence on Earth. And I wanted to continue that with a full interview of his interest and also what it means to us on Earth related to this Cygnus Mystery. And he also tied in kind of a bit of a connection with the Göbekli Tepe situation. And I wanted you to expand on that, Andrew. Can you talk a little bit about that connection?
Well, I have, yes. I mean, it first came up, you know, for me back in the late 1970s, but it wasn't really until I visited Göbekli Tepe and started to try and determine exactly what was going on here that it came up again. And this was the fact that what I noticed was that it seemed that the actual enclosures seemed to be focused either towards the north or the south. And the fact that Göbekli Tepe is built on the top of a mountaintop in southeast Turkey, where you originally would have seen all four directions, you know, very easily, it became clear that it was some kind of astronomical observatory. So it was a case of trying to understand what stars it was looking at. So I worked with a chartered engineer by the name of Rodney Hale, and we looked at stars in the northern sky and looked at stars in the southern sky. And it became clear that only one set of stars, and in particular its brightest star, was in the frame. And this was Cygnus, the swan, also known as the Northern Cross, which is a very prominent constellation placed on the Milky Way, which is the outer edge of our own Milky Way galaxy, and that it would appear that the builders of Göbekli Tepe had deliberately aligned various of the key enclosures to follow the path of the setting of Deneb, the brightest star in Cygnus. And this is interesting because we find this interest in this same constellation all over the world. And although most people are aware of the interest among the ancients of constellations like Orion, for instance, and perhaps even, you know, the Pleiades, whatever, it's a fact that Cygnus was an extremely important constellation in the ancient past, particularly at the end of the Paleolithic era, coming into the early Neolithic, because its stars had previously occupied the position of pole star. This is a turning point of the heavens. Obviously, you know, somewhere that was seen in the past to be almost like the point, a tunnel, a point of exit from this world and a point of entry into the sky world. And even after the Cygnus stars no longer occupied that same position, which was around 14,000 BC, it would seem as if that area of the sky continued to be important, you know, to various peoples all the way around the world, from the Eurasian continent right the way across to the North American continent, and that it remained deeply embedded within the cosmological views. And what's been interesting is that its significance was overridden eventually by a number of different factors, other star groups, you know, probably prompted by the precession of the equinoxes and other key stars taking over the role of pole star, but also by the fact that the cult of the sun began to dominate world religions from around, you know, 8,000-9,000 BC, almost certainly because when the agricultural revolution spread what's known as the Neolithic, you know, ideas around the world. And now suddenly the sun, instead of the moon, or indeed the stars, were important to cyclical seasonal activities, you know, like obviously planting crops, you know, the growing of crops, the harvesting of crops, and, you know, and those sort of cycles. And that's why Cygnus probably went out the window at that time. But you can find vestiges of its interest all over the world, from the Great Pyramids of Egypt to Göbekli Tepe to cave art of Southwest Europe, even down to Native American mound complexes right the way across North America. All of these seem to have as their focus what they call mound-to-mound alignments to two specific constellations, one of which is Orion, one of which is Cygnus. And this is obviously no coincidence. Those two constellations are almost like the yin and yang of ancient cosmologies, really.
You write about the connection of this Cygnus star constellation and Göbekli Tepe and some of the other civilizations that were around during the emergence of Göbekli Tepe over 12,000 years ago. But did you find a connection? I mean, because that's that's over 1,000 light years away. Is there a connection that you found in other cultures to the Cygnus constellation and an energetics?
Well, I mean, it's weird because obviously working with the idea that Cygnus was important in ancient times, and that it was fundamental to ancient cosmologies around the world, that there must have been some kind of point of emergence of these ideas. And I was already aware that there was an interest in the cult of the swan, which is the main symbol of Cygnus, particularly in the Eurasian continent. And I was aware that there was a big cult of the swan in southern Siberia on Lake Makau, which is this massive inland sea, and that this cult went back at least to 20,000 years ago, possibly even 25,000 years ago. And I'd written about this in my book, The Cygnus Mystery, so this wasn't really new, but I couldn't really link it directly with what was going on at places like Göbekli Tepe or Egypt or whatever. However, as the years rolled by, I began to realise that there was actually a paper trail, as it were, that led all the way from Mesopotamia and Babylon and even Egypt through places like Göbekli Tepe, eastwards and northwards, right the way through the Russian steppes and various Paleolithic sites there, taking us all the way back into southern Siberia. And this is something I bring out in my new book, which I'm going to call The Cygnus Key. Now, I know it sounds very much like The Cygnus Mystery, but there's a reason for it. And that's the fact that The Cygnus Mystery is out of print and the publishers won't give me back the rights, you know, because of stupid modern, you know, e-books and things like that, which permit them to trickle out a few copies every year. So I thought, well, bugger it. I'll just I'll just write a brand new book and to replace it. And the thing is it's not the same book. It's a completely different book. It's almost like a complementary version of what's already come out, but takes it on to brand new levels. And what it does is it shows that this universal idea in Cygnus constellation can be traced all the way back to southern Siberia between about 20 or 40,000 years ago. And that one of the key elements of it seems to be an interest in music and musical sounds, something which came to be known in Greek Hellenic tradition as the music of the spheres. And this is the inaudible sounds that are supposedly made by the planets and the fixed stars as they plot their course through the sky, and that this was something that could be replicated through the use of musical instruments, but instruments that were attuned very specifically to certain types of what's known as intervals. And these are, you know, sort of two different notes that are specific distances apart. And this was something that was incorporated a lot within architecture, as well as within geometry and musical instruments and stuff like this. And it's found, I found it all over the world. This is part of the new work that I'm doing, which I shall be revealing in The Cygnus Key. But what I started to realize that there was a relationship between all of these ideas and the foundations of music and our very first use of musical instruments that possibly goes back both to the Neanderthals and also, you know, the very first humans who would seem to have been in touch and getting their ideas from this other type of archaic human that seems to have been a cousin of the Neanderthals called the Denisovans. And the Denisovans' last stand are in the very area where the swan cult originates, certainly by 25,000 years ago and arguably much earlier still. So I start piecing all this together and I realize that it may well have been that all of these ideas came originally from the Denisovans and were actually gifted to humanity as a huge, great package to do with sound technologies, cosmology, even architecture, stone tool making techniques and things like this, that all are known to have had their genesis in southern Siberia between 20 and 40,000 years ago. And this is the very area that the Denisovans had their last stand. And the Denisovans themselves would seem to have been extraordinarily advanced, you know, creating beautiful jewelry. They rode horses, they had tailored clothing. They had decorated clothing. They would appear, according to the legends, and by the way, there's every reason to suggest that they were extremely large in size, possibly as much as 7 feet in height, and that they may well have been the giants of legend, and that there are legends in the very areas where the Denisovans were talking about these races of giants that existed in the area, and it says that they were the ones that built the first stone monuments of the region. And although this might seem a little bit sort of disconnected with the rise of megalithic cultures at the end of the Neolithic or the beginning of the Bronze Age in these regions, there is some evidence to suggest that some of the monuments in this region predate the Neolithic period. And this is something that I go into in the book and may well be extremely ancient.
You write about the connection of this Cygnus star constellation and Göbekli Tepe and some of the other civilizations that were around during the emergence of Göbekli Tepe over 12,000 years ago. But did you find a connection? I mean, because that's that's over 1,000 light years away. Is there a connection that you found in other cultures to the Cygnus constellation and an energetics?
Well, well, look, firstly, Cygnus as we see it from down here on Earth is just a collection of stars at different distances between our solar system and the furthest reaches of our own galaxy, possibly even beyond it, because clearly there are other galaxies that appear as pinpoints of light as well. So, you know, that's all it is as far as we're concerned. But of course, obviously, there are various objects within the Cygnus constellation that are of great interest. Obviously, there is the bright star Deneb and those other ones which form the a triangular group known as the triangles. And of course, Deneb itself is one of three stars forming part of what's known as the Summer Triangle. Also, Cygnus itself in Greek mythology was the poet and musician Orpheus, and that his instrument known as the lyre was placed next to him as the constellation of Lyra, which is the brightest star of which is Vega. And all of these in the same area of sky. And it does seem as if there is some tradition going all the way back, you know, to the Paleolithic age, that coming from this direction is some kind of musical melody, some kind of music of the spheres, some kind of tones or sounds or something which could be interpreted perhaps by shamans and priests and musicians and conveyed through the use of musical instruments and the enhancing of sound acoustics within architecture so that they may become audible in this world, and that because these sounds were considered to be divinely inspired, they were associated with the, you know, the cosmic source itself, you know, the source of creation, and that it was therefore able not only to help induce altered states of consciousness, but also to perhaps affect construction or form in the outside world. In other words, yeah, these were sounds that could be used to create material existence. That is exactly what these people seem to have believed in the past. And some essence of this comes down to people like Plato and Pythagoras in their writings. And I find it very interesting that Pythagoras, for instance, was supposed to have been taught by a Hyperborean by the name of Abaris, who is very commonly considered to be a shaman of some description. Now, although this place Hyperborea is just seen to be like a mythical land to do with the north wind, somewhere out of reach of mundane reality, all the indications are that originally it was located in the area of the Altay Mountains of southern Siberia, the very area where the evidence of the Denisovans has actually been found. And in fact, the whole story of Hyperborea revolves around the cult of Apollo. And Apollo was the god of music. And his sometimes son, of course, was actually Orpheus, who he taught to play the lyre and all the rest of it. So this whole connection with music just extends and extends and extends. And it's very much associated with the whole area to do with southern Siberia. And the Altay Mountains in particular. And it's all of these ideas that all begin to all dovetail into the very same conclusion. And that's that the Denisovans have some connection with our origins to do with our ideas of cosmology, theology, technologies, and much more besides. But as I said, all of this is brought out in the new book, The Cygnus Key, which is coming out probably, I'd like to think, by the end of the year.
I mean, really, what do you think of this Denisovan population? We find just fragments of them, but it looks like they were somewhat sophisticated and may have been a group of humanoids that were somewhat influential in our evolution.
Not really. I mean, not creators of it. It's not. I mean, they themselves probably died out by about 40,000 years ago, perhaps later, maybe around 30, you know, that if we sort of stretch it a little bit. But what's important is not so much them continuing the tradition, but their hybrids. The hybrids have the DNA both of ourselves and the Denisovan. So they're carrying that legacy forward. And that legacy goes southwards into India in the pre-Vedic cultures. It goes southeastwards into Indonesia, and obviously places like Korea and Vietnam. It goes eastwards into China and Japan. And of course, it's brought westwards as well, although not necessarily with Denisovan hybrids. More likely is that they're going to be Neanderthal human hybrids, because the territories of the Neanderthals, who reached quite a level of society, but not as high as that as the Denisovans, it would appear, we interbred with them at a very early stage. And it certainly seems that the area around southern Siberia and the Altai Mountains was the meeting point of all of these different types of humans, whether they be Denisovans. There were Neanderthals there, and there were anatomically modern humans. It was almost like a real Tolkien's Middle Earth. You know, if you can imagine all the different types of creatures and beings that exist in a Tolkien novel, that's exactly what southern Siberia would have been like. So there were opportunities for all sorts of different computations of hybrids, and there was possibly even a fourth type of hominin, which we don't even know what they look like yet. You know, plus we know that there were hobbits in Indonesia, in the island of Flores, possibly down to around between 10 and 20,000 years ago, that they're known today as Homo floresiensis. And they were a completely different species. They're not even sure how they developed from the hominin family tree. I mean, they possibly, split off at a very early stage. So in other words, there are lots of opportunities here for different types of evolution going on. And it's my belief, and I think I hopefully put this somewhere, I'll certainly put it in the new book, is that with this hybridization comes new types of mindset that a benefit from those of their mother and father, if you like, you know, the two different types of hominin, you know, whether it be Denisovans and humans, or Neanderthals and Denisovans, etc., and that this in a way helps accelerate human evolution.
You make some pretty startling assumptions about the Denisovans, and that they may have been megalithic builders, fashioned musical instruments. They engineered landscapes. There's a lot that you present, and it's interesting to know. I mean, how old are these monuments? And what are the significances of this thought?
Well, look, that's impossible to say, of course, because you can't date stone. There are one or two methods that have been used with some degree of success, but essentially you can't date them. This is why Göbekli Tepe is so important, because it was covered up at the end of its useful life around 8000 BC. So we can get good, solid carbon-14 dating from the walls of enclosures, from burials and stuff like this. When you come to other monoliths, and perhaps even, you know, dolmens and things like this, which you find in places like southern Siberia, you can't date them. And they've and because they were used at various periods to try and scrape around and get a bit of, organic materials to do carbon-14, it's not necessarily going to give you the date of their construction. I mean, the objects might, the stones themselves could have been re-erected and used in other monuments. This is exactly what happened, for instance, in Brittany. There is a massive monolith there, which was probably up in place by at least, say, 5,000 BC. But it was then taken down. It may not have even been properly erected in the first place, some people suggest. But then parts of it were reused to create some of the earliest dolmen monuments at a later date. And so, you know, in other words, something similar could be going on. But we are looking at various monuments in the southern Siberia area that could be older. But exactly how old, it's very difficult. And I think that we just have to accept the possibility that the idea of megalithic construction may not have begun with the Neolithic peoples, in the post-Ice Age period, that it may well have been going on at a much earlier age and then died out for tens of thousands of years and was restarted again during the Neolithic.
Michael Cremo, in his books, describes very, very ancient humanoids on Earth, in some cases in the millions of years. I think in one case it's 10 million years old, he finds Homo sapiens. And is his work at all an influence on you?
Well, I think he's onto something. I do. I mean, I've known Michael for many years, read his books. And the more I find out, that the more I am convinced that humanity is cyclic, or certainly had more than one cycle, at least. Anyway, I mean, for instance, just in my own local area of Essex, which is in southeast England, I found what they call eoliths. Now, eoliths are stone tools, quite crude, that are supposed to come from the dawn of human history. Now, they date back prior to what we call the Pleistocene area, which is the time of the Ice Ages. Can't remember the exact date, but one that comes to mind at the moment is about 800,000 years ago, although I think it probably started earlier than that. But before this, you've got earlier epochs, particularly ones called the Pliocene and the Miocene. We're talking about, you know, early millions, you know, sort of, I don't know, 3 to 5 to 10 million years ago, going all the way back to essentially, you know, the time of the dinosaurs, which is the Cretaceous, although in between there's one called the Eocene period. Now, okay, the importance of this is that these eoliths have been found towards the tail end of this period, generally during the Pliocene, some during the Miocene. So that makes them millions of years old. Now, we know that the earliest humans started to make tools in Africa around 3.2 million years ago, although just recently there's others that have taken it back even further to about 3.7, but we don't even know who made those. There's actually nobody around in theory to have made them. Again, this is all in Africa. But just recently, they found fossil remains of early humans in Eastern Europe that go back 7.2 million years. Now, these were probably quite primitive, you know, ape-like creatures that were just beginning to evolve into humans. But the significance about this, of course, is firstly that they're not in Africa. They're in Eastern Europe, which has already suggested to some that maybe we should be looking elsewhere for the absolute genesis point of humanity, something that's seriously going to upset people, seriously. And secondly, if people were kicking around, you know, these ape men, if you want to call them that, in 7.2 million years ago, how did they evolve? How far did they evolve? Let's say just in 2 million years. You know, if we, you know, in 2 million years, it takes you up to about, you know, 5 million to 4 million years ago. What the hell were they doing? You know, I mean, what type of culture did they achieve? And, you know, could they have been creating these so-called eoliths, which were very popular amongst anthropologists in the late 19th and early 20th century? And in fact, Michael Cremo has written extensively about eoliths, found all over the world, including some in my neck of the woods. You know, I think that these eoliths may well represent evidence of activity of early humans that were probably wiped out in one or more cataclysms, almost certainly of a cosmic nature. I mean, for instance, in the very same area where, well, almost within feet of each other of where I found these eoliths, at a place called Danbury in Essex, I've also discovered evidence of what's known as tektites. Now, tektites are the byproduct of an impact event. So in other words, when an extraterrestrial object comes down and explodes or hits the ground, it melts all of the rock around. And it does so with such an impact that it sends it flying up into the air as like molten glass-like substance, which on its way back down cools and falls to the earth, you know, almost like sort of like hail, if you like, you know, like the most horrendous hail you could ever imagine. And the strewn fields of tektites are found at various places around the world. I mean, in Indonesia, for instance, right the way across to Europe, in the area of Czechoslovakia, the so-called Moldavites, to places in Africa, the Libyan glass of the desert, you know, some of which has found its way into the jewellery of Tutankhamun, and et cetera, et cetera. Chesapeake Bay in the eastern United States, lots of these tektites have been found. Generally, you can find dates. Now, most of these are millions of years old and in theory have no impact, as it were, excuse the pun, on human evolution. But those that probably occurred, let's say, around 3 to 5 million years ago would have had, if we now know that humanity existed by 7.2 million years ago. It's very likely that they did wipe out earlier forms of humanity. So I think Michael Cremo is on the money in his work. I mean, I can't necessarily vindicate everything that he says in his books, but I don't think that, you know, that's necessarily always necessary. I think he's just trying to highlight the fact that this evidence of human activity is coming out from incredible depths in the geological record, and that we need to account for it.
Let's talk about this alien megastar that has been in the news recently and that you have featured in a number of your articles. First of all, it's really a phenomenon because apparently it's blocking the light from the constellation, from a group of stars. And the speculation is that it is artificial of some kind, and you know, there's different hypotheses about what it could be, how it functions, but just the sheer size of this thing must be huge.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, but firstly, just for the listeners, I think it's important to just do a little bit of a backstory. And that's the fact that we're talking about this star called KIC 8462852, otherwise known as Tabby's star, after the astronomer that discovered it, which was Tabitha Boyajian. And basically Kepler space mission looked at this star, sent back data suggesting that periodically it was dipping its light in an extraordinary manner. On one occasion, 16%, on another occasion, 22%, and on others, not so much, but still in a manner which was just so unusual that something weird was obviously going on there. Now, she initially proposed that it was probably a swarm of comets in some kind of weird elliptical orbit going around it. But one of her colleagues, Jason Wright of Penn State University, said, well, hold on, you know, this is the sort of thing which we've been told to look for as possible evidence of some kind of alien megastructure, something that would be utilized to take the energy from the star and transfer it somewhere else. Now, the guy that first came up with these ideas was Freeman Dyson, a physicist in 1960, and he conceived of the idea of this Dyson sphere, like something that would actually completely enclose a star and possibly would have its own ecosystem, its own. It would act be as a platform on which, you know, whole races could exist. But, you know, there are other types of ideas like Dyson swarms, Dyson rings, Dyson series, which all serve the same sort of function. But, you know, there are lots of different possibilities with this star of what's going on up there. I mean, the most recent theory is that it is a cluster of what they call rogue asteroids. It's been suggested that the star is burping after having swallowed a planet. It's also been proposed that it's nothing to do with the star at all, but it's just stuff passing in what they call the interstellar medium between us and the star. But my colleague, Rodney Hale, the engineer that I've worked with in connection with places like Göbekli Tepe and Giza, he's also an amateur astronomer and really knows his stuff. And he's been physically modelling the objects that have been crossing in front of that star. And all I can say is they look extremely weird. I mean, you know, we're talking in generally here about big ellipses or disks with trails coming out the front and the back of them that look very odd indeed. And these do not look like comets or any kind of usual object that you would associate with this type of activity, and they're huge. I mean, Tabitha Voyager herself has suggested that they could even be the size of the star itself. I don't know whether that's correct, and I also don't know whether they're natural or artificial. And I think that in order to try and get a better fix on all of this, I think we shouldn't look at them too materialistically. You know, we're thinking in terms of our own civilization, what it would do in a few thousand years' time. And that means things with nuts and bolts, basically. I don't necessarily think that that's the case. I mean, life, if it does exist out there in the cosmos, which clearly it does, may be much different to what we have down here. It may well be that the objects are themselves intelligent, that they could represent some kind of, you know, plasma form or silica-based life or something which doesn't even need, you know, two arms and two legs. You know, it could be energy-based. So I think we need to think outside of the box. And I'm doing an article at the moment, which I'm just editing as we speak, which is all about the star and all about Rodney Hale's work. And it will also show that there is evidence of cycles within the Kepler data of number sequences, which should ultimately not be there. But the fact that they are could help both predicting future events, but also that they may well be evidence of what French astronomer Luc Arnold predicted we would find back as far back as 2005. And that's what he called attention-grabbing signals which would convey information within the creation of light curves, light dips like this that would be seen by future space missions like Kepler. And that's exactly what we've got. And I think that we should at least look at this data and not dismiss it out of hand, because it may well be that there is some evidence of intelligent conveyance of information, which cannot be ignored here. And I'm doing this article, which will be available very shortly.
Can you speculate what the future holds for Earth and this star constellation Cygnus? I mean, is this something that we are going to begin to have serious data collection around? Is it something we can begin to predict we will uncover in the future? Because obviously, I mean, it's I said 1,000 light years from Earth a while ago, but I guess it's 1,480 light years from Earth. That's an enormous distance. I'm just curious about that.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, if we do find that around the Cygnus star, you know, Tabby's star, there is some kind of extraterrestrial intelligence, firstly, how do we communicate with it? Because it is, as you say, and you said 1480, but it's actually now been pinned down to closer to around 1300. I know it doesn't make an awful lot of distance if you're trying to fly through space, but it's a case of, if they're looking at us right now, what they're seeing is not us today, but they're looking at us as we were 1300 years ago. And in the same way, we're doing the same. When we look at what's going on there, we're looking at events that took place 1300 years ago. So if we do see aliens up there, how do we communicate with them? Well, we can send them a message somehow, but it's not going to reach there for another 1300 years. And by the time they've replied to us, 2600 years have gone by. So that's a little silly, really. And I mean, you would have thought that whatever forces are behind the creation of this universe would have at least built in some kind of mechanism or ability that will allow us more direct forms of communication. And I think that the only answer at the moment is that it can be done on a subatomic quantum level, perhaps using processes of quantum entanglement. This is the idea that when two particles are created, one splits off, it creates twins. Now, I don't know why it does that, nobody does, but one of the twins will go off in one direction, one will go off in another direction, and it doesn't matter how far away they get, they will still be linked together through some kind of non-local process. In other words, there's no connection between them. It doesn't matter how far away they go, whether it's from one end of the universe to the other, that link will always be there. Now, if you can imagine that's just one particle and that there are infinite amount of particles, electrons, photons, whatever it is, that are dancing their dance all the time, some of them within my head, some of them within your head, some of them within everybody else's heads, the chances are that when the dances are taking place, that, you know, that's our opportunity to convey information. In other words, you know, if I'm thinking a certain thought process and that creates a certain, you know, quantum system of particles doing their own thing, some of those are responding in the same way in your mind. And that allows what we might call telepathy or remote viewing or even precognition to take place. I mean, precognition is something which suggests that future information can come back to the present. Well, on a subatomic level, there is no time. These splits in particles can occur across time. One can go back into the future. One can go back into the past. And they will still retain that link, in theory. So, you know, we can try and communicate with this megastructure star, instantaneously using our mind, using human consciousness, which is also something that connects and affects the quantum world. And that's absolutely no question about that at all. So can we use telepathy to communicate with them? I think this is what it comes down to. And remote viewing. Answer, absolutely. Of course we can. But then the question comes, how do you interpret this information? How accurate is the mind in conveying information? And the only answer to that is patterns. You have a number of different people all attuned to the same thing, and you look for patterns. And those patterns are recorded down, and that gives you a better picture of the information being received. But, of course, the information that could come back might not simply be on the here and now. It could well be that any information could go back into the past and affect any period of history, possibly even the time of the pyramids and the constructions of the Great Pyramid, for instance, and all of the incredible geometry and mathematics in there. Because as I will show, and that's a separate article to what I'm doing at the moment, but that there is a relationship between the numerical sequences coming out of Tabby's star and what we find being projected within the geometry of the Great Pyramid. Now, it could be a coincidence, but it could well be, as my colleague Robert Bouvard has been saying in his lectures recently, that information was placed into the Great Pyramid as far back as 2500 BC in the form of mathematical formulas and things like that. And, you know, and connections with extraterrestrial sources that we only today can begin to interpret. In other words, it's a blueprint to something, a little bit like the blueprint that came through in the film Contact, which was obviously a film that was based on a story by Carl Sagan. And I think that Carl Sagan was a genius. And, you know, he was forward thinking in these ideas a long time ago. And, you know, we can learn a lot from going over what he wrote in books like Contact or his other more serious books like The Cosmic Connection and books like that.
In that article that you wrote called The Cygnus Constellation Mystery, you present a number of speculative overviews of what this megastructure could be. And you also use the term star lifting. I want you to talk a little bit about what star lifting is. But some people have considered the megastructure to be possibly a Dyson sphere, where an advanced science would be harvesting the energy from either a dying planet or a planet in existence that is not functioning for with a life form, but could be giving off enough radiation to power nearby planets. I mean, this is extremely advanced. I mean, out of this world science.
Well, there's two answers to the question here. Firstly, to do with star lifting. Star lifting is a more advanced form of the alien megastructure Dyson sphere idea. That was to try and take energy being radiated out from the star, whereas star lifting is actually directly scooping up the mass of the actual star. Now, whether that be hydrogen, helium, or the rare metal content, I don't know. But you're right, there is a very good video on YouTube that you can watch and listen to what star lifting is all about. And it's a very viable idea. And apparently, it wouldn't actually be that difficult, to be honest. It's quite crude, the actual way that you can achieve it. Now, I actually find the idea of star lifting more appealing than the idea of solar panels around the star drawing off energy, because there seems to be a trend of the dimming of the light of Tabby's star that's been going on possibly for the last 110 years. One particular survey by an astronomer called Bradley Schaefer found that the light had dimmed from the star over a period of 100 odd years. You know, he studied photographic plates from Harvard University to achieve this finding, but that it had gone down by about something like 20%. And then two other astronomers, Ben Montaigne and Joshua Simon, found from the Kepler data that this trend continued, and that over a period of 4 years, the light from the star went down by something like 3%. I mean, absolute 3%, meaning that a few hundred years' time, it isn't exactly going to exist if it goes on in this way. Well, that's exactly what you would expect from star lifting exercises, because you're gradually removing the mass, you're making it smaller, you're making it dimmer, and there could be a number of different reasons why you're doing this, not simply to remove the materials, but to deliberately actually make the star dimmer. That may be because, you know, it's too bright for your planet or whatever. I mean, there's a whole host of things. You could even try and move the star, and it becomes easier if it's dimmer. I mean, as I said, this article online this video is incredibly good to explain how it can be achieved and why it would be done. But going on to the idea of the alien civilizations and why science is taking it so seriously today is that there is a shift. I'm not sure why it is. A lot of it's to do with SETI and its search for extraterrestrials, because that is moved into two different fields now. One is about communication through things like radio signals and pulses from, you know, lasers and things like this. And the other is what's known as artifact SETI. And this is looking for specific information to do with objects that could be in orbit around stars and trying to make themselves known. Very much like what's going on around Tabby's star in the Cygnus constellation right now. And that's why astronomers like Jason Wright are taking all of this so seriously. I mean, you know, he came out and said, look, this is the sort of thing that we've been told to look for. And, you know, if we're looking for an alien megastructure, so take it seriously. And many of his colleagues are working with him, and all of them are in the camp where they want this to be real. They want this to be the real thing. They want it to be an alien megastructure and confirmation of alien intelligence is existing out there. But they have to be cautious. I have to be cautious to some degree in what I say, because the problem is, it's not that, you know, that they're going to be poo-pooed by their peers or their contemporaries. It's not so much that. They don't care that, you know, the evidence is there. It's they don't want to be left with egg on their face if it is found to be natural, and it could be eventually. So you have to put these clauses in everything that you write to say, well, look, it could be an alien megastructure, but on the other hand, it could be a swarm of comets. It could be a cluster of rogue asteroids. It could be this. It could be that. We don't know. And you have to say that at this time.
I guess the ultimate question is, what is the outcome of this discovery? How do we utilize this information? And what does it mean for us here on Earth? I mean, do we develop a science to be able to reach out, you know, thousands of or 1,300 light years away? Do we communicate in some form? How do we utilize this information? Because I mean, the science of our planet has, you know, there are telescopes, radio telescopes, optical telescopes pointed at this. Even our space telescope, Hubble's looking at it too, I believe. So what's the outcome?
It's going to be simply through adopting various different types of study on various different levels, whether it be to do with what they call the spectra, which is the literally the colors that are radiated out from the star at different frequencies. That can tell us whether something is cold, something is hot, whether it's close, whether it's far away. It can tell us what's going on the star, whether the star is being affected at the same time. And what you then do is you build up not just a bigger picture, but also a percentage towards whether it is natural or whether it is artificial. And you'll then reach a breaking point on one or the other where it almost becomes like a, you know, impossible to continue one idea and as opposed to the other. And that's all you can do. I mean, because it's, as we say, it's 1300 light years away. You know, we're not even going to have any good pictures of the star anytime soon. You know, we've got to create new telescopes and put them on the edge of our solar system and take photographs in that direction to get a good picture of the star. And that's going to take generations. So at the moment, we are clutching at straws, but the people that are clutching at straws have the intelligence to interpret the meager information that's coming back correctly.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that. That's it for today's program. Hey, come back next week. Each week we have something that is pretty amazing. Earth Ancients is the number one resource for all things ancient Earth past, mostly on known and unknown civilizations. So, hey, I hope you have a great day.